Well, we started talking about the journals, and this statement by W.T. Moore, who is a historian of the Restoration period, the Disciples of Christ don't have bishops, they have editors. He was not terribly fond of the journals and the influence that they had. We talked about the three kinds of things that attach themselves to the church, the cooperative meetings, and we'll talk about that in the future, Bible schools and Bible chairs at the different colleges, and the religious journals. And as we talked about the journals as last week, we looked at the scriptural justification for having the journals in the first place. And of course, that's where we always have to begin. Those things that are not scriptural, we don't need to be engaged in those things. But we did find that there is a scriptural basis for trying to spread the gospel using the printed word. And so let's continue. And I'd like to think about the nature of Restoration journalism. It was the journals that were published by editors who engaged in journal writing in part because of just the nature of the time that they lived. Remember, this is when America is on the frontier. The Restoration movement is most abundant or most widespread in the frontier areas of the country. And these are folks that were fiercely independent. They believed sincerely that every man could understand biblical information for themselves. And so because of that, you had a proliferation of these journals, in part because anybody that had a pen could write a journal. Well, you had to have the financial wherewithal to publish it. A lot of them started journals, and then the journals failed because they didn't have the financial wherewithal to keep them going. But you had multiple journals because there was this conviction that anybody could speak, anybody could understand the biblical information. And that's a proposition that I wholly support. You don't have to have gone to a divinity school. You don't have to have a fancy degree. And in fact, part of the argument that was made in some of the journals was that you shouldn't have paid preachers at all. In fact, they called them, those people that were opposed to having paid preachers called them hireling preachers. And they didn't like the idea that the church had gotten beyond mutual edification. Just, it was your turn, you spoke on Sunday, and they had gotten to the point where they had professional preachers. Now, there's an odd sort of understanding that you have to come to. A lot of the folks that were publishing these journals were, especially the ones that the journals continued for some time, tended to be men of financial wherewithal so that they could publish the journals. And a lot of the paid preachers had less money than the people that were railing against them as hirelings. So there was kind of that little bit of irony there. But what happened, because you had multiple journals, was you had multiple approaches to almost any subject. Sometimes the people agreed with each other on what the outcome was, but they got there in different ways. And they argued then about the best way to get to the outcome. So you had a lot of different approaches to most of the subjects that were discussed. Now, the different approaches didn't always happen within the pages of a single journal. David Lipscomb and Alexander Campbell were two of the editors that were most likely to publish in their journals opinions that they disagreed with. A lot of other people didn't ever publish anything that the editor disagreed with. And so it was in the belief, and this was the belief that Alexander Campbell specifically talked about. If you have the free exchange of ideas and both sides of a matter are presented, sometimes diametrically opposed. He entertained people who supported having the Lord's Supper on a weekly basis, and some people who supported having the Lord's Supper. And this was particularly the position that Alexander Campbell took, that you could have the Lord's Supper on a less frequent basis than weekly. This idea of a weekly observance of the Lord's Supper was not completely, it did not completely pervade the movement, at least in the beginning. So,
hey, Dean, where did he get that idea?
That in the free exchange of ideas, truth rises to the top. A lot of people would trace that back to Locke and the influence that Locke had on Campbell, not necessarily Locke himself, but Haldane's and the can't remember the name of the other well-known preacher in Scotland that he studied with. Remember, Alexander was headed to the United States and his ship wrecked and he had to go back to Scotland. So he was in the university in Scotland for almost 18 months before he was able to make the trip to America. And it was during that time that Campbell was introduced to the Haldanes, and they kind of entertained this notion of the free debate of ideas. The Haldanes did not subscribe to the notion that you had to take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. Now, that was where Campbell kind of started. And then he changed his thinking about that largely because of the influence of James O'Kelly. O'Kelly was the first of the four major reformers to come to that conclusion. And remember, Campbell's goal when he broke away from the Baptist Church was to establish a framework within which Christians could be united. So it's not surprising then that he would welcome the free exchange of ideas and the presentation of ideas that he might not have agreed with. Does that answer the question you were asking, Lenny?
Yes. In other words, he compromised his position to be in conformity with some of the other movement leaders.
Yeah, he did. But yeah. Remember, he compromised from less frequent observance to eventually reaching weekly observance.
Exactly.
So in his case, compromise meant accepting a more frequent observance.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dean. I appreciate it.
At least that's my understanding of the way that it developed in his mind. Now, the thing you have to understand about these journals is that often it was a personal operation. You had a single individual who was the owner, the editor, the publisher, who wrote the lion's share, if not all, of the material that was included in the journal, and he was also the distributor. Now, some of these journals were quarterlies. Those tended to be the ones where people didn't have a whole lot of money. Some of them were monthlies. Some of them were every other week. And a few were weekly. The ones that were quarterlies tended to fail largely because people, they wanted more frequent intercourse with the journal. They weren't willing to wait for a quarter. This is a time when, remember, they didn't have TVs. They, you know, you didn't travel. You were isolated. So this was your means of getting information. And people wanted it more frequently. Some of the journals were a corporate activity or a collective activity. It was the publication that was done by a committee or a society or sometimes a stock company. They would even form companies and sell stock in the company. And you had a board of directors that appointed officers and set policy and controlled the publication. Some of these journals that were corporate kinds of journals tended to accept advertising from secular businesses. And the way that worked is that many times the journal became an advertising outlet for a publishing house that was printing Bible study material. And you see that today. You have the one that comes to mind is Truth Magazine. Truth Magazine is a journal that's owned by the same people that publish Bible study material and sometimes homeschooling curricula. And they advertise those in the journal. So that was kind of what kept some of these journals going. But it didn't matter whether we're talking about something that was an individual effort or something that was a corporate effort, the profit motive had to be there. It dictated content. Sometimes it dictated language. And what they began to discover was the more sensational you could be if, in terms of just the language that you use to describe something, the more sensational you could be or the more contention that you could build, the more successful your journal was. That's just like newspapers. If we've almost gotten beyond the age of newspapers anymore, but papers in England started publishing nude photographs because of the profit motive. The more sensational, the more lurid, kind of like, what is it that they say in the TV news, blood sells? And if it bleeds, it leads. Well, the journals kind of got to be that way because of the profit motive. And that it's just almost inconceivable that somebody would have the independent means to publish a journal on his own. Probably the only person who had the independent means to do that was Alexander Campbell. David Lipscomb approached it, but Lipscomb's money came from the college. Alexander Campbell's money came from he married well and inherited a great deal of land. So for those two people, the profit motive wasn't quite as strong as it was for some other folks. But I don't know. I like watching and listening to public radio, and I watch NP or OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting. And it does bother me that it seems like once a week, the whole night is devoted to fundraising. They're just hitting you up for money all the time. And the televangelists that are on TV today, you know, you watch their programming. Sometimes it seems like half of what they do is asking for money. Now, the journals didn't necessarily ask for money, but what they did was they begged for subscriptions. And in a twisted kind of way, many of the journals even wanted the churches to subscribe to the journal for every one of their members. And that's the way that they said, well, the journal is not supported by a church. The church is just getting subscriptions for its members. Some of the journals started selling advertising for a page or a number of pages that they included in their journal in the back, which was a directory of churches. And you paid to have your church listed in the directory of churches, so when people were traveling, they would know where you were. And that serves a very real purpose. There are today resources so that becomes less and less important. There are resources. Steve Rudd publishes on Bible.ca. He has a list of churches and gives their addresses. So it's not as important that you have this advertising vehicle. But that's the way that they kept up subscription rates. Most of the journals couldn't sustain the expense. Many of them published maybe two issues and then went out of business. Sometimes they sold to another owner or something like that, but there were very few of these journals that continued for a long time. Campbell and the Millennial Harbinger and the Christian Baptist, those were his two journals, and David Lipscomb's Gospel Advocate were the two that persisted for a very long time. Large Quarterly persisted for a long time. It was one of the few quarterly journals that was able to sustain itself, and that was published by Moses Lard. Now, since they were private businesses, there should have been no organic relationship to the church. And most of them were very careful to keep from establishing an organic relationship. And we'll talk a little bit about the colleges and how it was difficult for the colleges to do this, to stay away from trying to establish an organic relationship with the church. The journals occupied this odd ground. They differed from other private businesses in their purpose and their nature. Some of them, as I've said, carried secular news and carried secular advertising, but they were primarily religious in nature. Their purpose was to edify or to convert. One man said any relationship of a paper to the church in the thinking of brethren that is any more than this, just simply the fact that they're both talking about religious matters, must be derived from a traditional view of papers that perceives of editors as occupying, and this is what this phrase is very important, a unique place in the church for which there is no precedent in the New Testament. And they argued, and it's an argument that I understand, that no human institution, whether we're talking about a school or a society or a journal or a paper, has the right to be supported by contributions from the church, however noble its work. I don't have a problem with the church using the journal as a tool, but I do have a problem with the church supporting the journal, which is not overseen by the eldership, and letting them do the work that the church is supposed to be doing. Does that make sense? Sometimes I have a hard time explaining that to people. These journals did a lot of things that were really good. They made it possible for well-reasoned arguments and good writing to be seen in these far-flung churches. Many of them didn't have elders. They didn't have well-versed preachers. It was self-edification, and it was people that knew how to read, basically. And that was about all that they had. And the journals that were available made it possible for them to see good arguments developed, whether it was about the Lord's Supper, or it was about the issue of rebaptism, or it was about the weekly observance of the supper, or the necessity of water baptism. These journals were able to spread the gospel. Campbell's Millennial Harbinger was more than 600 pages every year. It is an amazing piece of writing. Other journal editors described Campbell's Millennial Harbinger as a journal of dignity, showing unusual editorial competence, commanding the attention of Campbell's own followers, and get this, and of other religious leaders of the time. So it wasn't just Campbell's followers that were reading the Harbinger. It was other preachers that may have disagreed with him. They were reading the Harbinger. Some of them were converted. Some of them weren't. Some of them read the Harbinger in order to understand what the argument was so they could frame their own argument against what Campbell was saying. But among the editors, of these papers. Moses Lard was probably the most erudite. He was approached by, I believe it was the Atlantic Monthly when it was just in its beginning stages. The Atlantic Monthly was a literary journal. And he was asked to write for the literary journal. That's how well he wrote. Now, Moses Lard turned it down. He devoted his time to Lard's Quarterly, which was a personal publication, and to preaching. And the reason that he turned down the opportunity to write just literary writing, you know, like Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain or Edgar Allan Poe. The reason that he turned that down, and he was that quality of writer, was because he was afraid it would take away from his time as a preacher or an editor of the of Lard's Quarterly. So these guys were very good. Now, some of them weren't. Some of the journals were just they were just somebody grabbed a pen and went on a rant, and it wasn't very good, but some of it was. And it had the effect of increasing the reach of the gospel. These journals made it possible for people to hear really well-spoken people, even though they lived out in the hinterlands. They might not see anybody for, months at a time, but they could get these journals. And because that was the case, there were a lot of people that were converted. There were a lot of people that grew in their relationship with God. There was a lot of edification. And it should also be said that having the news of what other Christians were doing was an encouragement. And so these guys would, if there was a lectureship that was being held in Cincinnati, even though you couldn't attend, it was encouraging to know that this kind of thing went on. And, you know, maybe once in a great while, you would have the opportunity to attend one of these lectures. But just knowing that it was happening was still very, very encouraging to people who were in many ways kind of isolated because of where they lived. Now, there were some dangers. And the dangers in many cases arose even though the editors never would have wanted the thing that happened to happen. I don't think that Alexander Campbell ever wanted what was written in the Millennial Harbinger to be considered as a test of orthodoxy or to replace the Bible. And it did for some people. They didn't say, what does the Bible say about this issue? Their approach was, what did Campbell say about this issue? And if Alexander Campbell or the pages of the Millennial Harbinger said, this is something that the church needs to be involved with, then that's okay. And it was okay because Alexander Campbell said it was okay. Whether I agree with the conclusion that they reached or not, that should never be the test of whether something is biblical, something that God wants us to be engaged with. Now, I've read Campbell. He writes far better than I do. I wish that I'd give anything to be able to write like he did and to be as smart as he was and as insightful as he was. But he cannot become, and no journal editor can become, the standard of truth. And it happened to David Lipscomb, it happened to Daniel Summer, it happened to Moses Lord, the people that had journals that continued for some time and built a following. And I am convinced that Campbell would have been so disappointed that that was the case. But it did become the standard for orthodoxy. And it replaced the Bible. And then there were the battles between editors. And some of these were pretty, were downright petty. My conclusion is that the editor was seeking a personal reputation, or he was seeking subscriptions, and he had to foment this contention and this battle with someone else. That happened between Ben Franklin and T.D. Larimore. It happened between Campbell and Franklin. They disagreed. And I don't think that those editors were petty, but there were a great many that were. And remember that the profit motive is there, and you can gin up profit if you can manufacture a confrontation. That continues with I think it's getting worse with the 24-hour news cycle, and so many people are vying for news. If you have to say, and here's a scoop that you will only find here, there's something wrong. You know, exclusive on CBS, or exclusive on Sean Hannity, or exclusive, whatever, doesn't matter. You're just trying to buy subscriptions or build your listener base. That's just a battle between editors. Sometimes the journals, in spite of, I think, most of the people beginning with noble aims, began to print nothing more than the opinion of the editor, and sometimes they reflected the bias of the day. Sometimes it was a misunderstanding of scripture that, you know, somebody got it in his head that when Peter said no prophecy of the scripture is of any private interpretation, what that meant was nobody gets to decide what it means. That's an absolute misunderstanding of what Peter was saying. But it could get into a journal, and it could get repeated, and those people that were willing to say, well, my journal editor or the editor of the journal that I particularly agree with, he says this is what it means. Sometimes those misunderstandings of scriptures just got repeated and repeated and repeated, and nobody argued with it. Sometimes you had absolutely erroneous conclusions that were based on faulty reasoning. For the life of me, I can't remember the journal that I read it in. It was a well-known journal, and they sponsored or published debates between individuals. One of the debates had to do with interracial marriage. One person took the position that interracial marriage, in other words, if a white man married a black woman or a black woman married a white man, or given the time that this was happening, the 1950s, if a American soldier, an American GI, married a Japanese bride, that was a sin. And this was published. It became widespread. A lot of people, because of that, began to believe it. The ironic thing about that debate was that the person that this fellow was debating in the pages of this journal happened to be a black man. And the guy who was conducting the debate kept saying, "What would you say if your daughter wanted to marry a black man?" And when you find out the identity of the people that are involved in this, that kind of yellow rag argumentation just demeaned the whole situation. And it never should have happened, but it did. And if your particular journal, your guy, was opposed to something, then you couldn't argue against it. It's kind of like political parties today. Another danger was that you could develop intra-editor inconsistencies. And that's my way of shortening this idea so I could fit it on my overhead. Intra-editor inconsistency refers to the fact that a particular editor could develop a blind spot. He would argue that, for instance, the church could never contribute to the American Christian Missionary Society because it was a separate institution. And at the same time, argue that the church could contribute to a college. Those two things are, it's the same principle. But because your pet was the college, you could support the college and you couldn't support the American Christian Missionary Society. There was a big deal made about the fact that Alexander Campbell in the beginning was opposed to the American Christian Missionary Society and later served as its president. So you had the intra-editor inconsistency. And then there were questions about whether journals ought to publish opposing viewpoints. Some journals censored what was allowed to be printed in the journal. If you disagreed with the editor, you couldn't get the article published. And he did that in large measure. The way that it was defended was to say that I cannot countenance error. I will not give error a voice. And because you could censor what was put into the pages of the journal, they often did. And the censorship was exercised by the editor. So you had one person who is in charge of figuring out what can be said. That's a danger. On the other side of that, the point that we've already made is that when you have a controversy, you get more subscriptions. So sometimes editors would encourage the other side to present their best argument, and then they would, in the pages of the journal, they would respond to the best argument. Those took on kind of the character of some religious debates where you have two people that are in the same room talking about the same thing, but it's like they never heard each other. They never listened to what the other person said. They each had an argument, but there was no response. They were not responsive to each other. And you saw that a lot. And then you had journal editors who would stack the deck. You get the worst representative of one side, and you ask him to write the pro article, and you get someone else who's very capable and tell him to write the article in response. Well, you've stacked the deck and you know who's going to win. And then, and this was maybe one of the biggest dangers of the journals. You had division that was created between brethren over practices that had never been seen. And one of the things that we'll talk about as we continue our discussions is the Sand Creek Declaration. This was the 1950s. The Sand Creek Church had been in existence for a long, long time. And what happened was they started meeting in a log cabin. Then they had a little wooden clapboard church building. And then they built a nice brick building. And then there was a division. And the question was, who was going to keep the building? This thing went all the way to the courts. And even the courts recognized that you guys are fighting over things that you've never done. So we're going to talk about the Sand Creek case and how that was impacted by Daniel Summer, and he preached a sermon called The Declaration and Address, and it was a horrible situation. That was one of the things that was, Sand Creek went to court and we have the proceedings and we know what the events were like because the court, in rendering a judgment, told us what had been going on. A lot of times this kind of thing was happening, and we only know one side of the story. In the case of Sand Creek, we know both sides of the story. So we'll talk about that, but these journals would whip up a controversy over something that had never been practiced. And one of the things that was a frequent source of controversy was rebaptism. They talked about that. Oh, they talked about that a lot. Churches divided over instruments when there had never been an instrument in the building. And there was never any intention to put one in the building. But they divided because that was what was being discussed. And you had to have a position. So that's what was going on with the journals. Questions? I will say, if you've never read Large Quarterly or The Millennial Harbinger or Walter Scott's The Evangelist, if you can go to the library, the religious college that's over by the University of Oregon, and you can go in their library and you can check these out. And it's a fascinating read. It really is. But be prepared for these guys to write using some kind of flowery, to us it seems like flowery language, but the stuff was really well written. So if you ever get a chance and you have some time on your hands and you're downtown and you don't want to go to the U of O library, you can go to the Bushnell Library and check up on these journals. They have the copies in stock. I used to have copies of these. I had Large Quarterly, The Evangelist, and Millennial Harbinger, and The Christian Baptist. Had complete sets. And they were gathered together and they were republished, back in the 1980s, 1970s. And when I stopped preaching the first time, I gave them away. Wish I hadn't done that now, but I did. So now I go to the library and read these things.
Dean, said issue over some kind of baptism, and I didn't catch that word.
They called it rebaptism. In other words, if you converted someone who had been baptized in the Baptist church when he became converted, left the Baptist church, did he have to be rebaptized?
I knew somebody who wanted to get rebaptized when we were in Sunnyvale, that one of the ladies that we'd been studying with wanted to be baptized, and she left one hand out of the baptistry. So she wanted to be baptized again so that all of her would be baptized. And of course they permitted it because it doesn't matter, but it did to her. So,
Now that's not the same kind of situation. That's would be rebaptism, but that's not the same kind.
No, it's not the same.
Yeah.
Because we did have a Baptist woman that said she'd already been baptized, but she, after studying with her for a while, she realized the difference, and then she was baptized into the church.
Yep.
So I've seen both. It's very interesting. By the way, you did an excellent job tonight. I was impressed. Not that I'm not always, but I really got it. It kept my attention all the time and understand it, that's for sure.
You know what I always say, even a blind squirrel finds an acorn once in a while. So
yeah.
I did something.
Yeah, but you're not blind, and you found the acorn before I even thought about it. So
if I found an acorn, it was probably an accident. Thank you, though, Jimmy. You're very kind. Any other questions? This idea of rebaptism, this was a controversy that swirled around Homer Haley for many, many years. Homer Haley was originally baptized in the Disciples of Christ, or by a Disciples of Christ preacher. And there were a lot of journal editors who took him to task and said, you must be rebaptized. And he said, no, I was baptized for the remission of my sins. And he did not, by the way. When we start talking a little bit about colleges, I don't know how many of you know that Western Oregon University was originally begun by the Disciples of Christ. And if you go to the cemetery that's in, it's not in Philomath. Now I can't remember the name of the town where Western is.
Monmouth.
If you go to Monmouth and walk around the cemetery, you'll see some of the people that are buried there are names that you've heard if you've read these journals. So it's really fascinating. They're not that anymore, but at one time it was.